Scott Pruitt became the head of the EPA. He is now the new Senior Vice President of Climate, Environmental Justice, and Community Revitalization at the Hip Hop Caucus. And Mustafa, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate you having me here. I
appreciate you coming to Baltimore and sitting here to talk to us. It's good to have you here.
Yes.
And your reputation precedes you. Our friend Jackie Patterson thinks the world of you, so that's all I needed to hear.
Well, that's a blessing. If Jackie says it's all right, then you're moving in the right direction.
That's right.
Yes.
So let's take a step backwards. So how many years were you at the Environmental Protection Agency?
In a total of federal service, 24. I also did a stint on Capitol Hill, where I was with Congressman John Conyers, who was chairman of the Judiciary Committee, and I've done a little bit of work with the White House also over those years.
So how did you get involved with the EPA in the beginning? How did that happen?
Never thought it would happen in a million years, but I'm glad that I was blessed to have the opportunity to, you know, have the opportunity to kind of learn and be a part of that process. So I actually came to the Environmental Protection Agency as a student. And needed to do an internship to finish some educational work, and met some incredible folks, one by the name of Dr. Clarice Gaylord, who was the first director of the Office of Environmental Equity, which became the Office of Environmental Justice.
That would be under Bush?
Yes.
Bush II, the second
yes.
President Bush.
Yes,
right.
It was. An interesting time with lots of different opportunities to grow and build and create a foundation. And I hope we have a chance to talk a little bit about those early days.
Yeah, I want to hear about that.
And how things sort of transpired. But that's how I came there. I never thought in a million years that I would work for the federal government.
What'd you think you would do?
Well, if it was up to my parents, I would have been a doctor or a lawyer.
So it's not just in Jewish families.
No, it's not. No, it's not. I had law books since I was 6 years old.
Uh-huh.
So there were some expectations in that space. And I'm thankful because in my work over the years, both the law and medicine and public health have played a critical role in some of the things that I had to work on and be able to sort of help others work on. But yeah, started off as a student, and the rest is history, as they say.
And what brought your name, obviously stunningly in the light here in the last few weeks, was this letter that you wrote to Scott Pruitt, who is the new administrator of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, a man who came out recently saying that he did not think that the global issues were caused by industry.
Mm-hmm.
And we can talk a bit about that a bit.
Sure.
But so it moved you to this and something else moved you to write this letter on March the 8th,
yep,
saying you resign.
Yes.
As of March the 8th.
Yes, yes. There were a number of things that played into that. One of them, and I really haven't talked about this before, for those who know the history of the environmental justice movement, it actually started, or the flashpoint was in Warren County, North Carolina, back in the early 80s. And 1982 was the real flashpoint when a number of folks who were there in that community were protesting against PCBs being placed in their community in a landfill. And
this is a black community for the most part?
It was primarily African-American. Mm-hmm. And, you know, folks were willing to lay down in front of those trucks that were trying to bring those cancer-causing chemicals into their landfill. And, you know, in thinking of the, you know, real dedication of individuals who are willing to do that, I thought that it was important for me to stand up for the vulnerable communities that I had been working for a couple of decades. And I wanted to do it in an intelligent way and in a respectful way. So I remember when Administrator Pruitt was going through his Senate confirmations. And at that time, I believe it was Senator Booker who had asked him a question around environmental justice. And he said he knew of the concept, but that was about as far as that went. So I thought that it was important in my resignation letter, if I shared with him the impacts that continue to happen inside of our most vulnerable communities. And when I'm talking about vulnerable communities, I'm talking about communities of color. I'm also talking about low-income communities and working-class communities, you know, white communities in West Virginia, throughout Appalachia, through in the Rust Belt, on the Gulf Coast. And we're also talking about indigenous populations, because sometimes people get it twisted, if I can say it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And they think that environmental injustice only impacts communities of color. And yes, it does disproportionately do that. But there are others who are also a part of that. So I thought that it was important to be able to share with him some of the impacts that are still happening inside of communities and why it's so important to work on those. And then there were a couple of other sort of moments that moved me. One of them was the budget, or the proposed budget, and the cuts that they were talking about making to programs beyond just the environmental justice work, because it is the work that happens inside of those communities is connected to lots of different programs. So when I saw the zeroing out of those programs and then also the cutting of over 3,000 jobs, I thought that that was very curious. At the EPA, yes. Right. Because I was like, how could you possibly think that that would be a good thing? How do you think that that could possibly benefit communities by not having the individuals there who have a distinct responsibility for helping folks? And then the last sort of straw, as they say, that broke the camel's back was and seeing the proposals of rolling back regulations that communities had, you know, struggled for years. They want these regulations to be in place. They want those regulations to be enhanced, to be more protective of their communities. And I knew that the rolling back of these regulations would create additional impacts inside of our most vulnerable communities. So for me, I had to stand up on principle and share in a respectful way that I did not feel that they were moving in the right direction. So for me, it's a different set of values and priorities. And I did not see them having at that time a value on those lives inside of those communities. So I decided that I would share that information with them and I would take my skills and talents to places where I knew I could continue to do great work.
So did you ever hear back any response to your letter from Scott Pruitt, the administrator, or anybody else?
I have not.
You have not?
I have not.
But they accepted your resignation.
They did. And I thank them for that.
Thank them for that?
I do.
What do you think? What do you think would have happened if you stayed?
I don't think that I would have been able to continue to do the work that is so critical. And I think that we would not have the same amount of attention that we currently have on these issues. So if I was able to play a small role in helping folks to know, one, that there is this issue out there if they did not know it, to two, help them to have a better understanding of not only how we can address these issues, but how we can make real substantive change, because that was also in my letter.
Right.
I shared with them, you know, some examples of how folks have really been able to transform their communities when we listen to communities and then move forward on those recommendations that they're sharing with us. So that's the reason that I say it in that way, that, you know, I hope that this is being a blessing to those communities who have been struggling for, you know, decades now. It's been an interesting few weeks.
I can imagine.
Yes.
And I want to come back to this, the what communities are facing and what you see has changed. But we do have this divide in this country, right? I mean, I was reading an editorial that appeared on March the 10th in the Washington Times. Did you see that one?
I didn't, but I heard they had some interesting things to share.
This is how deep the divide. Can I just read a piece of it to you?
Sure.
And talk a bit about
sure.
this. So in the Washington Times opinion section, March the 10th, they wrote, "Environmental justice for the unaware is defined by the EPA as, quote, the fair treatment and meaningful involvement of all people regardless of race, color, national origin, or income with respect to the development, implementation, and enforcement of all environmental laws, regulations, and policies." That's the bureaucratic speak. Now for the layman's. It's the government's way of controlling the people by linking environmental degradation to civil rights, so specifically to the civil rights of minorities and the poor. And they go on to talk about how it's not true. The poor people, on the other hand, are forced by their lower incomes to jam to housings of roach-infested nearby trains, transportation hubs. And they have expanded, the EPA has expanded its role into every facet of human life, from regulating the air we breathe, to the land we develop, to the oceans we sail upon, the rain puddles that collect. That means environmental justice warriors have free rein to intrude, impose, and regulate on every facet of human life under the guise of civil rights.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's one of those opportunities, as my mother would say, an educational moment. because it goes to show the lack of understanding in that space. For one, the Environmental Protection Agency is not the central point for environmental justice. Environmental justice is a people movement, always has been, always will be. The Environmental Protection Agency has a responsibility in that space because of Executive Order 12898 that President Clinton signed in 1994. But also 17 other federal agencies also have that responsibility in addressing these issues in collaboration with communities. So communities define environmental justice, just like they define environmental equity and environmental racism are different terms that people have used. And for folks to not understand the history of the movement would do a disservice, because environmental justice was happening, or injustice was happening, before the Office of Environmental Equity, which was formed in November of 1992, came into being. So for someone—
That's what it was called then.
Yes, it was called Environmental Equity. And I remember sitting at a conference with Dr. Beverly Wright and others, and there was a elderly lady who was in the audience. And she said at that time, well, why are we calling this environmental equity? Because we don't want people moving pollution around to other places. We want it to stop. And then it began to move into environmental justice and the principles that were there. The other thing that I would share with folks who, you know, everybody has Google now. So I would say go take a look at the 17 principles of environmental justice, which actually came out of the first People of Color Summit in 1991. And that was made up of folks all across this country from all different backgrounds and a few folks from other countries as well, as they began to have conversations about the impacts that were happening in their communities. And people, you know, who were coming from Chicago would notice that there were similar impacts that were happening in St. Louis and were happening in Kansas City and so forth and so on. So, you know, it's important for those, I hope, well-meaning folks who may not necessarily know the history of the movement to get better grounded and rooted in it. And then they would understand that this movement, this set of work, is about helping communities to be healthier, helping to be more sustainable, helping them to be more equitable, and making real change. So if you're for strengthening our country, then you should be for environmental justice and addressing the injustices that are happening. If you're for creating healthy, clean jobs for your families, that's the same thing that folks are asking for in communities who have been struggling to get traction in that space, and a number of other things that I'm sure we'll discuss as we move forward.
We will, and we're talking with Mustafa Ali, who was the administrator of an EPA for environmental justice and resigned, very well-known now, letter of resignation, now working with the Hip Hop Caucus, and we're kind of exploring the roots of this and also where we might be going with all this. As you were speaking, I was thinking about all the years you spent working with the federal government on and off in different capacities. Mm-hmm. Was there ever points in that time where you had your own difficulties in the sense that the environmental justice, as you said, is a movement. Mm-hmm. It's not a set of public policy. Right. And it's a movement that emanates from people's communities, whether it's here in Baltimore in Curtis Bay or whether it's in South Carolina or whether it's on Standing Rock, wherever that happens to be. Mm-hmm. It's people fighting for their lives,
exactly,
for the earth,
mm-hmm,
right?
Yes.
And how poor people are the ones who always feel the brunt of this, whether in Appalachia, trying to live with all the dregs of strip mining, destroying their communities and their water and their health. So were there times when you were doing this because of the consciousness you have that you had difficulties at but being a federal administrator while you had groups kind of pushing and saying you got to do more than you're doing?
Yeah. Every day was filled with challenges and opportunities.
I'm sure.
And I'm very straightforward. I believe in real talk. You know, there were challenges with every administration. Some were, you know, moving the needle further quicker than others. But there was always at least incremental progress, which was always important to me because I understand that, you know, folks have different sets of priorities and goals, and finding and looking for opportunities to be able to intersect the necessary work with whatever that set of priorities and goals was, you know, not just myself. There were lots of folks who were, you know, going through that over the past couple of decades and trying to figure that out. Challenging moments. I was very fortunate that the majority of my time was spent outside of the Beltway. So maybe...
You didn't get stuck behind that desk.
Exactly. I couldn't have done that. That is...
You couldn't have done that.
I couldn't have done that. Right. And I'll tell you why. I share this with, you know, whether it's the president who wants to have a conversation, or you know, the person who's just newly being hired into a federal office, there's one lesson of many that I think everyone should think about. I don't know how you create policy if you have not spent significant amount of time out with folks, having conversations with Mrs. Ramirez in her kitchen or Mr. Johnson on his back porch about what's really going on in their lives and what is it that they're really looking for. Sometimes people would smile when I was in certain meetings and saying that I don't think that folks should be hired for higher level positions if they haven't had a significant amount of community experience. I think it helps you to be able to see the world through a different set of lenses, if you will. And I think it helps us to have better policy. Policy should be reflective of the needs of the folks who are out there and should not be based upon theory or those types of things. So I think that every administration should make sure that they have a cadre of individuals who have that experience and who have a voice to help you to frame that out.
And it seems to me in some ways that the people who make up what we call the environmental justice movement, people just, as you were describing, stand up across the country, not because they say I'm part of the environmental justice movement, but I'm here to save my community, my health, and my children's health, and the land we live on, or whatever that might be. Mm-hmm. But the forces arrayed are huge. I'm thinking here, Curtis Bay, the battle they've had because of the incinerator, and they've done a remarkable job there in that community to kind of stand up for themselves and build alternative ways. But whether it was Standing Rock and the pipeline is apparently is going to be open today or tomorrow with the oil flowing, or the gas flowing, I should say. Mm-hmm. And communities are in Houston, the oil companies, people have to live in the midst of the dregs of the oil industry around. So this is not an easy trick. I mean, you're arrayed against some of the largest, most powerful corporate institutions in this country.
Yeah.
That for decades thought, well, we can do what we want because it's just a bunch of poor folks. They're not going to say anything,
yeah.
Right?
Well, that's why it's important to have a strong federal presence. It's that check and balance. And that was some of my concern also with our new administration, that in the weakening of a federal family, I think that you put communities at a great disadvantage when you do that. You know, it's interesting. Many of us who've been doing this work for decades now, you know, our focus is on the present, but also on the future. And we understand that we may not necessarily make all the change that we want to make in this present moment, but we do this work so that our children, grandchildren will have a better future. And, you know, that's why it's so important to be able to bring people together and to be able to mobilize, which is extremely important in relationship to environmental justice, because there's never been a huge amount of resources there. But being able to pull people together helps to balance it out. I often say in my speeches there are two sort of different paradigms in our country. One is based on money and being able to utilize that to move things. And the other one is on people. And we know, I know you know, some of our most successful movements have been because people have come together and
right.
have said change is going to happen. I feel we're at that moment now as I travel around the country. Working with young people and others, folks are looking for an opportunity to get engaged. They're looking for an opportunity to make change. And what is also happening is that people are changing and raising their expectations. So we're all taking a look in the mirror and saying, have we done all that we should be doing and could be doing? You know, I think that over the next 18 months, we're going to see lots of more folks getting engaged in a process. And I think we're going to see people voting more and thinking critically about if I don't vote, there are real impacts that are going to happen inside of my community. So I'm excited about that. I know the challenges that exist in this space. And over the next 18 months, we will probably be faced with a number of challenges. But I also believe in the beauty of our country and that folks, you know, luckily we live in a democracy where you get a chance to stand up and say what needs to be said. But then moving past the talking, you got to get engaged in the process. And that is at the local level and making decisions about, are the folks who are representing you doing it properly? That's on the county level. That's on the state level. And then, of course, on the federal level. And we've got some opportunities coming up. And I hope that folks will continue to stay real focused.
Well, what I want to, I really want to explore the beginnings of this agency. Mm-hmm. Again, in more depth, where you think this might go. And a little bit more. Questions I really want to learn about you as well as a as an activist and as a person.
Sure.
And as a man. And we're sitting here on the Mark Steiner Show on Soundbites, and we're talking with Mustafa Ali. Mustafa Ali is the man who was administrator here at the EPA, who wrote that stunningly wonderful letter to Scott Pruitt resigning. We're going to talk about where his work is taking him, where it may be taking us, where the movement will be going. Stay with us. We'll be right back. In part by the Maryland State Education Association, from limiting overtesting to protecting public school funding, you can learn more about the issues facing Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's MarylandEducators.org. The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites are The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Welcome back, folks. This is still Mark Steiner right here on The Mark Steiner Show. And Soundbites are with a look at food, farming, the environment, and our energy systems. We have the distinct honor to be talking this hour with Mustafa Santiago Ali, who was the Assistant Associate Administrator for the Environmental Justice and Senior Advisor for Environmental Justice and Community Revitalization at the Environmental Protection Agency, now about to become the Senior Vice President of Climate, Environmental Justice, and Community Revitalization with the Hip Hop Caucus. But he wrote this letter that took everybody by storm on March the 8th, resigning from the agency, and we'll be linking to that letter on our website as well so you can see it yourself. And you know, Mustafa, things that we were talking a minute about during break was that I said, I'm sure that when you wrote this letter, you knew it would have an effect, and some people would pick up and take notice because that was the tenor of the moment. But I don't think you probably don't expect the power of your resignation would have on this country, nor on you, right, and pulling you from pillar to the post to be talking to everybody on the planet.
Yeah, no, I definitely didn't. I had hoped to just be able to educate the new administrator and share those three elements. One, that there are real challenges that are still happening. Two, that rolling back of regulations would have devastating effects on the communities that I've worked for. And three, that there are real opportunities that exist. And that the cutting of grant programs and some of the other things that were being proposed would limit opportunities for not only vulnerable communities, but lots of other communities as well. And we should be laser focused on building communities up. I'll just say it this way. That should be our focus on building. Our focus should be on building communities up. And I'll let those in the political world, you know, sort of work through some of the other building that is being proposed. I think we have that responsibility.
A quick personal question.
Yes.
So then we'll get right back into the heart of the matter.
Sure.
So you grew up in Morgantown, West Virginia. Is that right?
Not in Morgantown. Actually, in a little teeny tiny community of about 500 folks right outside of Prickett's Fort, which is a revolutionary fort.
Yes.
That's right there. My little community is a little bit further up the road, unincorporated, fantastic folks. I think that's where some of my core values come from, because in our little tiny community, you know, folks were always working together to help each other out. You know, I grew up running and playing on the hills and in the woods, you know, sort of a Norman Rockwell type of thing if you just looked at it on the surface.
Right, right, right.
You know, when we would go hunting, you know, we would bring back to our elders who couldn't get out to the grocery store and those types of things. When we went fishing, you know, we caught fish and we brought it back to folks. You know, if somebody had a problem with their house, folks came together and helped fix that, you know.
And was the community mostly African American, mostly black, or was it really mixed or mostly white? What was it back then?
We were one of the only families of color there. But everybody just came together. You know, it's amazing sometimes when you come to Washington, D.C., and you see the separation of people.
Yeah.
But when you grow up in a country setting, you know, everybody is just you, you know, and folks, you know, they watch you grow up and they make sure you stay on the right path. But they evaluate you on who you are and how you interact.
So I'm curious. I asked that question also because I'm curious what, if maybe you don't know this yet, but what the response is back home to your resignation in a community that many people probably voted for Donald Trump.
Well, they may have. I'm not sure who folks voted for.
Right.
You know, not a whole lot of conversation happens. It's amazing when you get away from major media markets and that type of thing.
Right.
Folks are more concerned with what they need to do to help their families move forward and make sure their communities are strong, that type of thing. I know my father and my mother are proud of me
for
living up to, you know, the expectations that they have on myself and my brother and sisters. And there's just one sort of major thing that they always expected of each of us, and that is for us to figure out how we could help others. Growing up in a family, you know, is very, very focused on faith. That's the foundation that we stand on. And I'm honored and very blessed to have had a family and a community who's like that. And I think that that is the core values of most families across the country. We have folks sometimes so much dealing with just surviving that it begins to break down, you know, those core values that make our country stronger and makes the country great. And that's why I think it's so important for us to stay laser focused on building communities up, making sure that there are strong structures inside of our communities, making sure that we're honoring all the folks who are in there. If somebody is struggling, then you reach back or you reach over and you try and help them. And that's why some of the actions that I have seen are baffling to me in relationship to some of the choices that are being proposed for our country. That's not who we are. That's not the foundation that we're supposed to be building on. And I don't think that that's the direction that we're really going to go. I'm hoping that men and women of good conscience on Capitol Hill will stand up and say, this is not who we are. And respectfully push back.
So that, I'd like for you to describe for a moment. Before we went there, we talked about some of the elders in the community who helped create this environmental justice movement, and we can talk a bit about them and what inspired, what moved that movement. Mm-hmm. But also maybe describe also in the process what some of the struggles are. I mean, for people to get a real sense of the depth of what people are struggling around.
You know, and I think that that is that's a big part of this where, like the article that you had read before.
From the Washington Times?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So if folks actually traveled to some of these places and had the opportunity to see the challenges that folks are dealing with, you couldn't possibly say some of the things that you say if you're a person who has any humanity in your soul. So, you know, folks are very familiar with the challenges that, you know, are happening in Standing Rock. Folks are familiar with the challenges in Flint with the lead in the water and the, you know, huge impacts on people throughout their life cycle. Lead can be very devastating,
right,
and can set you back and put you on a path where you're probably not going to end up in a very positive place. But those are just the ones that have gotten attention, you know, the big attention. You have places like the Manchester community in Houston, Texas. And I was there not long ago. And a phenomenal organization called Tejas, Juan Parras, actually helps to lead that work along with some other really phenomenal folks who are part of that. But when you're in that community, and if you're in your car driving there, and let's say I know in my car there's a button you can hit and the air recirculates in the car so you don't really capture what's happening outside. And when you get there and you put your window down or when you first walk out, and if you take that first breath of air in, it's literally like breathing in gasoline fumes. Mm. And these folks live with that type of a situation 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. And when you look around, you will literally see more piping and more stacks than you will trees. So how can that possibly make sense? How do you have a community that is literally surrounded by miles and miles of a situation like this? And that's just one example. You've got folks over in Mossville, Louisiana, if we want to stay toward on the Gulf Coast.
Fine.
And, you know, you have an African-American community there that has been there since slavery was over. These giant plants come in and surround the community. You have folks with high levels of benzene in their blood, dioxins in their blood, who have been struggling to be able to stop the impacts and also find some refuge, if you will. Some of the folks have been relocated. But if everyday folks ever went to a situation like that, they would be like, well, this doesn't make any sense. And that's the environmental injustices that are happening. You've got East Chicago right now, who's also dealing with a real significant lead issue. Now, folks are trying to, you know, get in that space and help out. But we've got these types of things happening all over the country. You've got Native American communities who are very, very tied to the land and the water, who, you know, being exposed to uranium and uranium tillings and the impact on their cultural practices because they can no longer, you know, utilize the fish that once was a part. Or you have other Native American communities that, you know, they may be basket weavers and they can't do that anymore as a part of their cultural practice because the reeds have now have pollution in them. So if you put them in your mouth and then you begin to weave, then you're ingesting that. Or you have Latino brothers and sisters also who are farm workers. You know, the impacts, and although we're getting much better, you know, there's still some significant impacts to pesticides or chemical plants, the explosions that happened in Texas not long ago. Or I can go to West Virginia and the Elk River where the chemicals went into the river and the impacts that were there for everyday folks getting up, going to work, coming back home and dealing with these impacts. Or the impacts that are going to come from climate and many people living along the coast. And, you know, we don't have to say anything more than Katrina right. to remember those impacts and folks not having the ability to be able to escape these types of things. Then after the storm, you know, injustices happening with the rebuilding and the lack of opportunities around contracting and subcontracting and being able to play a role in that space. So my work is intersectional. It brings in lots of different things. It's not just the environment. It's also housing and transportation and job creation and public health and so many other things. So there are lots of challenges that are happening. Elevated levels of asthma. When I was growing up, you could ask the question, how many folks in a school had asthma? And there'd be just probably a very few hands that would go up. I don't remember growing up anyone had asthma in my school, especially in my elementary school. Now, when I travel around the country and having conversations with folks, I ask that question. There are more hands that are up than down. So we've got to really get on top of these impacts that are happening, those real focused impacts that are happening in our most vulnerable communities, and then even some of the broader ones also that are happening. And, you know, it's a shame that we're not as focused because I think we do our country a disservice when we don't.
So when you look at what could be ahead of us, if the EPA is actually cut drastically by the numbers, the amount of money we're talking about, a third of their budget, environmental justice of the program's gone by the wayside, nobody to oversee oil, gas, any kind of development going on in people's communities and other kinds of issues like that. I mean, so because for the years, and I'm sure there was an arc between the beginning of this with Clinton to Barack Obama and now Donald Trump, and the Bushes in between. No, not Bushes in between, but the President Bush right after Clinton. The agency was pushed because outside groups came and said, we need to change. We have to listen to what's going on in our community. That won't be there.
Right.
Most likely will not be there.
Right.
So, I mean, the effect on communities can be devastating in the next 4 years.
That's the way I've been describing it. Yes. Because, you know, once these impacts become rooted, then it takes a long time to be able to, you know, turn back the clock, if you will, or to make things, you know, to move in a different direction. So that's the reason we can't go down this path. If we do, you will see additional illnesses. You will see, when we talked about asthma, you'll see more cases of that, especially if, you know, the work that needs to happen around air pollution is not happening. You know, that's going to happen, unfortunately. And I've seen over the years too many people get sick and too many people to die for me not to continue to be a strong advocate, along with many other folks who are out there also advocating for change. But that's one side of the coin.
Mm-hmm.
The other side of the coin is this administration, as I have shared with other administrations, you have the opportunity to be the champion for these issues. You have the opportunity to actually take this to a higher level than it ever was. And you can be remembered in history as that one administration who really shifted the paradigm in a positive way, that helped to create healthier and more sustainable and equitable communities. The one who said, you know what? Worker training programs make sense, and we can utilize those as we're having these conversations about getting people back to work again. We can utilize that in a way that makes real change inside of communities. We can be the one who says, you know what, we're going to have strong relationships with the states, but we're also going to make sure those states are doing the right thing. And we're going to support business and industry growing, but we're asking it and we're demanding it to do it in the proper way. Make sure that they have the right types of technology in place that don't create additional impacts. We can be the one that says when folks are doing zoning and planning, we're going to make sure that schools are not being built on old landfills. We're going to make sure that communities are not going to be placed in harm's way by new development that's happening. We're going to work in collaboration with each other to make sure that these things don't happen. So folks say sometimes that I'm the eternal optimist.
You sound very optimistic. You do.
I believe that if folks prioritize and value the lives of these communities, that they could do some fantastic things. So it is a choice to be made. If they are going to move down the road, one that is negative and creates additional impacts in communities, or if they are going to take a path that will be a beacon of hope for the future.
So how would you describe, just for a moment, going back historically for a minute, the what I alluded to a moment ago, the arc of change mm-hmm. inside the EPA, inside environmental justice, from the beginnings with Clinton and George Bush and then Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what have you witnessed? What have you seen? What do you know about in terms of how which the work that was being done there
sure.
actually grew and where you left it?
Yeah, well, it was actually an evolution. So it actually started at the end of the first Bush administration. So it was the environmental equity, environmental justice work conversation began in like 1990, okay? Under William Riley, when William Riley first came in.
Under George Bush.
Yes.
Right. The first.
Yes.
Right.
But I also want to make sure that we're not dealing with revisionist history, which seems to be in vogue. So let me make sure that I'm being very clear. The work that began in the agency started out of a set of recommendations that came from stakeholders. Through vigorous debate, pushing and looking for opportunities, they began to get traction. And William Riley, who was administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency at that time, began to engage with folks and his senior staff. And that's how the work of the agency started. As much as I like to share with folks that there are some really good folks inside of the agency, many of the changes that I have seen over the years have happened because of stakeholders pushing and engaging and those types of things. And that's the exact same thing that happened all those years ago. In the early days, by no means did this concept come into being, and then all of a sudden folks said, oh, yes, we should be doing these types of things. It was because of real hard, tough, engagement from the stakeholders all across the country. Folks like Richard Moore, who was with the Southwest Network. Folks like Dr. Robert Bullard, who at that time was at Clark Atlanta University. Dr. Beverly Wright, who was at Xavier University and who's now at Dillard University. Tom Goldtooth, who started the Indigenous Environmental Network.
Right.
Folks like Dana Alston, who's no longer with us, and Damu Smith, who was actually one of my early mentors, and Hazel Johnson, the mother of the environmental justice movement, who came out of the South Side of Chicago, whose community has been labeled the Toxic Donut because of the 17 polluting facilities that surrounded her community. And folks like Luke Cole, who's no longer with us, who is one of the, you know, really creative attorneys who also got engaged. And I could go down a laundry list of folks who were there in the beginning. Peggy Shepherd from WEAC, and so many other folks.
What's WEAC?
WEAC is
WEAC, I mean to say.
It's the West Harlem Environmental Action. And Connie Tucker, who was with SOC, and so many others. It was all those folks who were pushing. And I had the real blessing of being able to learn and watch. One of the things that really I will always remember is being at an early meeting of all the leaders that used to be in hotels. And people used to think, well, the real work was happening inside the room. No, the real work was actually happening in the lobbies, because afterwards they would all gather in the lobby. And the mother of the environmental justice movement, Hazel Johnson, she used to call me the kid. And she would take me by the hand and she would pull me over and set me down on the couch so that I could listen and learn. And that's what she used to always say. I want you to remember what you're hearing so that you can be more effective in this work, you and other young people. And I will always be grateful for her for taking that moment and, you know, pulling me in a loving way, but also in a way of you have a responsibility now. And many of us who are the younger ones who are coming up in the movement, we were sort of tutored that way. And I've been blessed. I've had fantastic civil rights and environmental and social justice leaders, but I've also had folks who worked in the states who've mentored me, and even a couple of folks in business and industry who really got it and helped me to understand the challenges that business and industry have in this space, but also finding those opportunities for traction have been helpful in being able to navigate this world and hopefully be a more effective advocate for communities.
And one of the important things here, I think, a couple of things, is that the face of the environmental movement mm-hmm. is literally changing.
Yes.
Changed.
Yes.
The leadership is changing. Because, you know, when this whole began in the 1970s, you know, Earth Day and the rest, and it was mostly young white radicals who came out of the anti-war movement and other places that kind of pushed ahead with this environmental movement. But environmental justice movement has forced the world to look at it a different way and also forced a change in leadership.
Yes, and that's an evolving process also. For those who are listening who might not know, folks created the environmental justice movement because they didn't have a seat at the table in the environmental movement.
Right, exactly.
And they were like, well, wait a minute. You know, we love trees. We love polar bears. We love whales. All of that is super important. But we also love the people who are in our communities who are being impacted. And, you know, there was a break there for a while. But now, you know, folks are moving forward and taking their respectful place in the leadership of this. And even in climate, if you look at the early conversations around the impacts of climate, you didn't hear a whole lot about the impacts on the people from climate. And that's how the whole climate justice, a part of how climate justice came to be, because now we're talking about, you know, the need for adaptation and resiliency, but we're also talking about who are the ones who are going to be most disproportionately impacted from these impacts from climate. So that's why I always talk about the evolution. It's an interesting thing. I'm fortunate that I did not have to see some of the things you saw. So, you know, in the early environmental movement with, you know, the rivers catching on fire, the Cuyahoga River.
Cuyahoga River.
Yeah.
Right. Yep, absolutely.
Yeah. Or, yep. You know, smog being so thick that you can't see,
right.
You know, the sky. And I thought it was interesting. I was watching a show the other day and Charlie Daniels was actually on the show.
Country singer?
The country singer.
Uh-huh.
You know, he has some great songs.
Yes, he does. Yes, he does.
And
you must have heard a lot of that growing up.
Well, I did. I know bluegrass. I do. As well as I know rap now, I know bluegrass. It was always interesting. Charlie Daniels had one of the first songs that sort of had a rapish flavor, which was The Devil Went Down to Georgia. And, you know, so I appreciate all musical genres, if you will.
Sorry, I mean to digress like that, but you're good.
No, it's fine. But he was actually talking about climate and the impacts of the environment and pollution. And he was saying, and it resonated with me when I was sitting there and I was reading, and then I looked up real quick when he started talking about it. And, you know, he was talking about as a country boy, you know, you really appreciate being able to look up and see the stars in the sky. But when we are not really focused on dealing with pollution, how that's taken away from some folks. So I thought it was interesting how these issues connect with so many different folks across our country. Sometimes it's just, you know, in a slightly different way, but it's the same goal of trying to make sure that we are protecting Mother Earth, if you will. So that was an interesting moment for me in hearing someone who I enjoyed some of his work over the years and the connection, if
that's
you
really
will.
That's really interesting. I think that's, this is the way that I think some of the it can shift. People use the word paradigm a lot, but it can shift.
Yeah.
When you connect people from Appalachia and people from Houston and people from that realizing that what they're all fighting around is the same.
Yeah. Right? Justice is justice.
Justice is justice.
You think about it. If I'm a fisherman, then I want to make sure that my water bodies are protected because I enjoy fishing, whether it's for sport or it's for subsistence. So I don't want to take fish back home to my family, to my grandmother, to my nieces and nephews, whomever it might be, you know, that unfortunately has been, you know, polluted or has toxins in it or metals in it, you know. And if I'm a hunter, you know that you need to also have, you know, a pristine environment for deer to grow or ducks or whatever it might be that you're into.
So I'm curious, so do you still hunt?
I do not.
But you did?
I did growing up. Yes, I did. I'm a vegetarian.
You're a vegetarian now.
Yes,
not hunting anything.
Which folks always they're like, get out of here. But I do. I am.
So you can respect somebody who has that.
Oh, sure.
That's something people, I think, sometimes in the worlds that we may travel in forget, that's a way of life.
It's culture.
It's culture.
Part of the culture.
It's like my friend on the res, in the Arapaho res in Wyoming, Wind River, has this joke. He said, you know what you call a vegetarian on the res? I said, what? He said, a bad hunter.
Yeah, that's true.
Right?
That's true. There's huge impacts that are happening in Alaska.
Right.
And brothers and sisters who are there, who I've met over the years and work with, you know, they're hunters. It's a part of the culture. And you respect that, you know. That's one of the things that we seem to be losing are the cultural aspects of who we are as a people and the value that they have. And I've been very fortunate that I've worked with, you know, so many different types of folks in so many different cultures. You know, there's a culture that exists in the Gulf Coast. When I was working on the BP oil spill and even before then.
You had to deal with that when you were at the EPA. That was one of the things that you were given charge of.
Yes.
From the EPA's perspective.
Yes. And but there's a culture there, you know, and when you damage the environment, you're messing with that culture, a piece of that culture that the folks have had for years as shrimpers and fishermen. So, you know, you got to. You want to honor that culture, and you also want to make sure that we don't make those mistakes again that takes away. And you see that as you travel across the country, that there's culture that exists in so many communities. If you're in rural communities or in urban communities, there's culture, there's beauty in that culture,
right.
And there's value in all of those cultures that exist.
So we've been remiss if I didn't kind of jump into this before we run out of time, which was your new role.
Yes.
And the Hip Hop Congress.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, caucus, yes.
So, I'm sorry, caucus. I mean, did I say Congress? I meant caucus.
You did, but we focused on Congress. We know there's not least to happen there.
So, talk a bit about this is brand new for them as well.
Well, the Hip Hop Caucus has been doing incredible work for a number of years now. Now, the portfolio that I'm developing is somewhat new, but they've been focusing on climate. They've been focusing on environmental justice, economic justice. They've been focusing on democracy and voting and getting young people's voice and youth engaged in that process, helping them to understand that they have power and that their voice matters. There is some new components to it. But Reverend Yearwood and the rest of the Hip Hop Caucus family have been doing incredible work. And the beauty of some of the things that they do also, along with infusing culture and policy together, is also, you know, the work that they do with athletes, entertainers, artists, and so many other folks who have an opportunity to more fully engage in some of the issues that we've been talking about today.
So what will Mustafa Santiago Ali be doing now that you're in the Hip Hop Caucus? What will you be doing?
Well, I will continue, of course, to be working on environmental justice issues, but we're also going to be laser focused on revitalizing vulnerable communities and helping to move folks from surviving to thriving, if you will. So, you know, I often talk about a fantastic example that I did, that I played a role in some of the work. There are lots of people who played a role, but Harold Mitchell in Spartanburg, South Carolina has the Regenesis Project and has done a phenomenal job down there. That's the community that I referenced in my letter.
Right.
And I could have referenced a number of other examples, but they got a $25,000 environmental justice small grant and have leveraged it to close to almost $300 million in changes now in their community. And their community looked a lot like America in the sense that, you know, they had issues with their transportation routes that were not beneficial in their community. So they had a community where there was one way in, one way out type of situation. They had railroad tracks going across, and the trains would sometimes sit there for hours and just idle. And in their community, they also had chemical facilities, brownfield sites, Superfund sites. So if there was ever an explosion that would happen, people couldn't get out of the community. So that's why the transportation route aspect was so important, to make sure that there's a new way of dealing with that. And then the beautification that goes with that. They also had an issue with housing. So you've spent some time in the South, so you know what shotgun housing
is. Yes, I do.
And so in the summertime, South Carolina gets warm. Some people would say hot. And so folks there sometimes are paying $300 or $400 for their electricity cost. Well, we've now got 500 new homes, green homes that are there, and it has lowered their electricity bills from that high number down to $67 a month. So that means folks have more disposable income to be able to utilize and however they see fit. They also, seniors had great distances to travel for health care. So they now have new health care centers that are there where before they didn't. The interesting thing about the healthcare centers is not only are they helping to improve the health of folks and address impacts, but they also are a job creator, because now you have those local jobs that are right there for folks who are working inside of that, and that helps to stimulate the economy. Also, as this revitalization was happening in this community, they utilized worker training programs, so local residents were trained in the building of the community. So it was a part of their vision. So early on, they identified some of the challenges in their community, but also what were the opportunities they were looking for. And that's the power of making sure that you have a community-driven process. They also have a new, I think it's close to 100,000 square foot community center. Everybody comes together. I've been there a number of times. It's amazing to see all the kids now have a place where they can come together. Educational programs are happening, so many other things. They had a food justice issue, a food desert, if you will, where folks had to travel a great distance to get to a supermarket. And for some folks, that's hard for them to conceptualize. They're like, well, I just walk down the corner and go to the grocery store, or I jump in my car. But folks had a great distance to travel. Now they have a supermarket in their community, which is amazing, the changes that happen when you can get to fresh and healthy food. And a whole bunch of other things that are happening. The Brownfield and Superfund sites have been cleaned up, and they're about to put a solar farm, 35-acre solar farm, on the cleaned-up brownfields. So remember when I talked about that $67 number? Well, that's going to be $0. They're going to zero out the electricity cost, and then the excess will be sold back to the grid, and the community and others can figure out what to do with that excess revenue stream, if you will.
So this is what's going to take up your time in the coming years with the Hip Hop Caucus.
That's what we're going to
do. Building this around the country.
Yes, exactly.
Well, I'm really looking forward to having many, many, many more conversations with you over the next few years.
All right.
See what you're doing and follow this through. This has been a treat. So we've been spending this last hour with Mustafa Ali, who of course was the man who wrote the letter to Mr. Pruitt saying he was leaving the EPA, where he had been the Assistant Associate Administrator for Environmental Justice and Senior Advisor for Environmental Justice and Community Revitalization, and is now a Senior Vice President of Climate, Environmental Justice, and Community Revitalization with the Hip Hop Caucus. And Mustafa, thank you so much for coming to Baltimore and stopping by our studios. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you for blessing me.
The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites is a production of the Center for Emerging Media, made possible in part by a grant from the Town Creek Foundation. Our senior producer is Mark Gunnery. Our producer is Imani Spence. Our research producer is Calvin Perry. Our production assistant is Nadi Ramlagan. Our engineer is Andre Melton. And our intern is Morgan Sr., Michael Dixon. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. Please send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@steinershow.org. And to podcast the Mark Steiner Show and share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. You can also learn more about Soundbites and listen to past episodes at steinershow.org. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.